You are listening to the Pronk Pop Show, presented by Raymond Thomas Pronk, the People's Paladin Pronk, propagating faith, family, friends, freedom, first. Broadcasted by Renaissance Radio, Radiating Reason, and KDUX Web Radio. Podcasted by ProntPops.wordpress.com and KDUXWebRadio.wordpress.com. You are listening to KDUX Web Radio, broadcasting live from Richland College in Dallas, Texas, with a voice of Richland College. My name is Raymond Thomas Pronk, the presenter of the Pronk Pop Show. Views expressed on this show are my own, unless otherwise stated, and do not reflect the opinion of KDUX Web Radio, Richland College, or the Dallas County Community College District. Welcome to the Pronk Pop Show. This is the Monday edition. A couple of stories. Two of them actually occurred over the weekend. And by now you probably have heard that Senator John McCain died at age 81. He'd been suffering from cancer. He lost his battle with cancer. And I'll have some comments. He did serve his country, and he volunteered to serve his country. First in the Naval Academy, then in the House of Representatives and the Senate, and eventually won the nomination of the Republican Party, but was defeated by Barack Obama. While I certainly admired his courage, his dedication, his service, I simply did not share his political philosophy, point of view. He was very much an interventionist. I'm just the opposite. He was for bigger and bigger government and really a military to support the American empire. I want a strong military, but not one where we're policemen of the world and intervene in country after country. So we had our differences, but I still would like to salute his service and dedication to country, and I'll have more to say towards the end of the program. The other story that appeared this weekend, and this is rather a sad story, and I think it's not the end of it, is that a former archbishop that served for 5 years as ambassador to the United States for the Vatican released a letter, and it discloses the fact that Pope Francis knew and covered up the scandal that's really sweeping through the church today, and that the church hierarchy, from bishop to archbishop to cardinal on up, has unfortunately known of the sexual predator priest, from priests to cardinals apparently, and did not act when in 2013 this archbishop confronted or made aware to the Pope that the bishop for Washington, D.C., who was subsequently promoted to cardinal, it was widely known he was involved in this, and wrote an 11-page letter to the Pope making certain charges. And unfortunately, the Pope's response is silence. It's incumbent on Pope Francis to either admit the charges, and I don't think this archbishop has a lot of credibility. Now, the spin on this, and I think this is Vatican spin, that this is a political situation. The Catholic Church, like much of America, is divided. You have liberal Catholics, even socialist Catholics, and I think the Pope is a good example of that. And you also have conservative Catholics, as well as leaders of the church, whether it's your local diocese priest, monsignors, bishops, archbishops, cardinals. People have political views. They're all Christian, and we're all sinners. But covering up the fact that priests were predators on children, both boys and girls, and then in the seminaries, on the people where you had homosexual priests engaging in those activities with seminarians and other priests. It's been a problem that goes back, as we learned in the Pennsylvania situation, for at least 70 years, I think longer than that. There is a cover-up, and they're breaking the law. That's something you need to understand. In the United States, what these people were doing, whatever their position, broke the civil law, and they should have been reported and prosecuted. Instead, they were either moved out or covered up. So I'll have some additional comments again towards the end of the program. Now we have a breaking news story, and that concerns what looks like, and this was breaking this afternoon, that the Trump administration is very, very close to finalizing. They haven't finalized it yet. Let me make very, very clear here. They're still in negotiating, but it looks like we have a what President Trump labels the United States-Mexico trade agreement. He wanted to replace NAFTA, the North American Foreign Trade Agreement. Now, given that's over, I think, 25 years, 24, 25 years old, it needed to be revised and it needed to be amended. Because if you think about it, over those 25 years, what's one area of, in terms of business, that's really bloomed? And that's internet commerce. And we're learning some of the details, but until it's finalized and signed, and even when it's signed, it still has to go to the Senate. And the Senate has to become legislation. I'm not going to play the telephone conversation that President Trump had with the Mexican president as well as his successor. And in roughly around 90 days in Mexico, the new socialist president of Mexico will take office. So they're trying to get this finalized, but I think it's going to take to next year before the Senate passes the legislation. There's just too much on the calendar. And the only way this will pass in terms of the changes is if Democrats, senators, vote for it. And yes, some certain leaders in the Democratic Party have been involved in this. This is good news for the Trump administration, President Trump. But what still needs to be done is to bring Canada in on this. And the Canadian representative is going to be in Washington. So hopefully we learn more. Because there are three parties to this agreement, the United States of America, Canada, and Mexico. And although Donald Trump is for, and I am for too, bilateral trade agreements, and it could be passed as a bilateral trade agreement, but you need all three parties to agree to, if you will, repeal NAFTA. And that's what I think needs to be done. Now, I want to say free trade agreements. I don't consider this free trade. This is government-managed trade, where you agree to certain terms and conditions. It's not free trade. You see, with free trade, you don't need an agreement. Today, if Donald Trump wanted to, he does not want to do this, folks, but the goal is any country that wants to have free trade, what do they do? There's no tariffs on any imported goods, and there are no what's called non-tariff barriers to trade. There's no subsidies. There's no currency manipulation. Any country can do that, and the United States could unilaterally do that. Now, that gives away certain leverage. I understand that. So we really don't have free trade. What we have is managed trade, where the government gets involved, in this case, three governments, and negotiates the terms that each government respectively can agree to. And usually the sticking points are, especially agriculture, which the United States has a lot of, and we do subsidize some crops. Much of agriculture does not get subsidized, but there are crops that do, and that, to the extent that we have that, gives an advantage to U.S.-grown crops, whether it's wheat, corn, cotton. I know I'm forgetting one. If we truly had free trade, what you have to see is no tariffs. And we have very low tariffs. It's really, Donald Trump is right. President Trump is right. It's other nations that have much higher tariffs than the United States. Sometimes two, three, four times higher. And what Donald Trump is trying to do is say, well, we want you to either eliminate those tariffs that you have on U.S. goods that our businessmen, farmers are sending to you, make it zero. And then when you export your goods to the United States, it's reciprocal. You get zero tariffs. That's what you want. A tariff is a tax. And to the extent that Donald Trump has used tariffs in steel and aluminum, it was largely first to get people's attention and to have some leverage, get people to the negotiating table and make it very clear we have a new president and he wants to renegotiate all our trade agreements, whether it is with China, Mexico, Canada, European Union countries, or anyone else. We're open for business. You're open for business. Let's have no tariffs. No subsidies, no barriers to trade, no non-tariff barriers at all and we'll sign it. Unfortunately, few nations will sign it. There are few, but very few. Because what happens is you're dealing with, now people call it economics. Economics used to be called political economy, which I think was a better name because a lot of economic issues today involve politics, both domestically and abroad. Every country has groups of people, call them interests, special interests, however you like to label them, that want the government to do certain things for it. And they will make campaign contributions to the people running for office to make sure that, for example, agriculture is protected, or steel is protected, or aluminum is protected. I'm a free trader. I'm not a fan of managed trade, but I understand you got to deal with the real world, and you have to negotiate. And you got to understand what you want, what they want, and where can you reach a middle position. But don't call it free trade. It's managed trade. And that's what President Trump is trying to do. He wants not only free, but fair trade. It's really not free trade. It's managed fair trade. That's, in essence, a more accurate description. So we'll learn more details of what's in the agreement. I think overall, NAFTA has been a success. Because if you look at the statistics, what's happened in terms of trade, exports? It's gone up, up, and up. And a lot of goods are, for example, exported from the United States to Mexico and then re-exported back into the United States. The biggest sector is automobiles. And we are getting some of the details out that, and this is another thing I don't like. What do we have in Washington today? We have two big government parties. And big government parties want to intervene into the economy and tell people what, for example, the minimum wage should be. And supposedly one of the terms of this agreement is if you work in the automobile industry, it has to be $16, a minimum of $16 an hour. Now, let's be clear about this. In the United States, Canada, most of the automobile workers, especially the older ones, but some younger ones, are making more than that. It's really in Mexico where, and that was the motivation for building the plants, you have a lot cheaper labor. So that's good news. So I'm not judging this until I see the final product, but it's good news that at least President Trump, who has been highly critical of NAFTA, now thinks, at least with Mexico, and I wouldn't be surprised by the end of the week, Canada will be part of this. But nothing has been finalized, and remember, Congress or the Senate has to vote on this. And I think realistically, we'll know a lot more after these, and they've already been engaged in many rounds of trade negotiations, and because of the complexity, you're talking on both sides, hundreds, in some cases thousands of people being involved. It's not a simple agreement to negotiate. And like I, if you've listened to the show, I was a negotiator. First for the United States Air Force on the F-15 program, and then when I went into industry on the F-16 program, primarily on international programs, and I negotiated with Canada an industrial benefits agreement, and it just takes time. And early on, it's a lot of fact-finding and trying to understand each party's positions and where you have agreement, agreeing to it, and there's always going to be areas that you're never going to get agreement on. You know, the best negotiation, no one is happy. Neither party is happy. It's not one person win all. It's not winner take all. So we should learn more, if not by Friday. There is a somewhat of an arbitrary deadline because if they can reach agreement Friday, then you have 90 days approximately to when the new Mexican president comes in, and they want to have this agreement not only signed but pass through the Senate. Now, is that going to happen with the Senate? I doubt it. I seriously doubt it. That's why I say it's more likely that when Mexico, Canada, and the United States finally resolve as many issues as they can, that we probably won't see a bill that President Trump will sign until, my expectation is probably February, could be even later than that. And that's what we want. So keep this in mind. It's good. Why is it good? If you listen to the last couple of shows, I pointed out that if anything can stop the good news that we're getting daily, that the economy is growing again, now at above market trend levels. In other words, historically, depending on where you start and stop over decades, the U.S. economy grows in the range of about 3% to 3.5%. Now, during the Obama years, the economy, for not one single year, there were some quarters that it was above that. We never had a 3% rate of growth. And it looks like for at least the second quarter, and most likely the third quarter, and we'll know those numbers, the advance estimates for the third quarter will be out right before the midterm elections, the last week in October. It looks like it'll be between 4 and 5%. I'm not predicting that, but it looks like it'll be definitely above the trend line of 3 and 3.5% and probably somewhere in the 4% range. And I caution you, although in terms of the midterm elections, you know, an October number of, let's say, 4.2, 3, 4, 5, it's terrific for the Republican Party. But you really want the second and third estimates, and the second estimate will be out the last week in November, and the final estimate in December for the third quarter. And people are looking at that. And the reason why this is important, the higher the growth rate, more jobs are created. More wealth is created, more income is created, more jobs are created. And that builds confidence in the performance of the U.S. economy, and that encourages entrepreneurs, business owners, to expand their businesses, invest in new plant and equipment, new locations, buying machinery, inventory, and in the process, hiring many more new people. That's what you want. You want a growing, booming economy, and maybe the trend will go higher. 5% or 6%. Now, over decades, it's hard to maintain that level of growth. It's not impossible, but it's hard. And the only way you can really do that is if you have the right economic incentives. And that means you need to fundamentally reform the tax system. And I've said this many times. That means replacing the tax system of the United States. I mean all federal taxes that are largely based on income, to change over to where the basis of taxation is consumption on new goods and services. You want a broad-based consumption tax. And that's along the lines of either a fair tax or my version of it, fair tax less. I'm not going to get into it other than to say, and I always point this out, some of the critics of that say that is a regressive tax. It's a sales tax, a regressive tax. No, it's not, because both the fair tax and fair tax less has what's called a tax prebate. It's to deal with the legitimate criticism that sales taxes, just like Social Security taxes, payroll taxes, are regressive. The burden is greater on those that are either no income or low income, really low income. And that's why both the fair tax and fair tax less have a tax prebate. And the way you would pay your taxes is when you check out. You go to buy a loaf of bread at the local grocery store. I go to Kroger. Let's say it's a dollar loaf of bread. Right now, embedded in that price, in all prices, are taxes. They have to be. Businesses have to recover what they pay in taxes. And it's been estimated that that's somewhere between 20 and 23%. That's why the fair tax has a 23% rate. They made theirs revenue neutral. My fair tax less is lower. It's 20%, but it's not revenue neutral. And the reason is this. We have to get back to a fiscally responsible government, financially responsible government, where the federal government every year, not every 50 years, balances the budget. That means you're going to have to definitely cut federal government spending. Are the Republican Party balancing the budget? No. Are the Democratic Party, have they balanced? No, they haven't done it. You have two political parties that are essentially for big government. Not limited government, not minimal government, not no government, huge government, massive government, way beyond the means of the American people to support this government. That's why every year, and we're running huge deficits of hundreds of billions of dollars. We are burdening future generations that have not been born, as well as existing generations. That's how out of hand, out of control government spending is. And trade is very important. Now, at one time, our percentage of gross domestic product in terms of exports of imports was fairly low. Now, over time, as we've had, and it's been over 70 years, the trend has been, again, through negotiations, managed trade, really. Countries have reached agreement, and the export and import sector of not only the United States, but other countries have grown. That's good. That's beneficial. You want to expand trade. Now, I'm not going to turn this into an economic lesson. I could, but I'm not. But that means for you and me a rising standard of living. Up until recently, you go to a Walmart store or another store, wherever, Costco, wherever you shop for your goods, and you notice, can't help but notice, that many of the goods that you are buying come from a number of countries, not just China or Mexico or Canada, but a number of countries. And the same is true with our goods. So I'm all for free trade. I'm not a big fan of managed trade, especially multilateral agreements, where you have a number of countries part of the agreement. I agree with Trump. The best situation in my mind is to have bilateral agreements, because you should change them as the situation changes. And if one country feels that the other country is taking advantage of, for example, the United States, and that's what President Trump has accused the Chinese of, as well as Mexico and European Union, you renegotiate. I don't think we're going to get a quick agreement with China. I hope I'm wrong, but I think China has taken advantage not only of the United States, but the European Union countries and other countries. And once that persists, they don't want to give it up. So it's going to be tough negotiating on the part of the U.S. trade representatives. And again, this is a big team, folks. You know, when I was negotiating defense contracts, our teams were relatively small, you know, maybe a dozen or two dozen people. We had other organizations involved in it, and that's what you got to keep in mind. But these are very complicated, a lot of details. They just take time. That's why you have what's called rounds of negotiation. And these have been ongoing since President Trump took office. And I think President Trump, to some extent, jumps the gun. But you got to remember, we are in an election year, so it's somewhat understandable. Either a Democrat or a Republican would jump the gun, because we have not dotted the I's, all the I's, crossed all the T's, and made sure that the terms and conditions are what the United States, as well as Mexico or Canada, can agree to. And that's the way you want it. What you don't want to do is just willy-nilly agree to whatever country we're negotiating with, or don't even bother to try to renegotiate. I'm not being critical of President Trump, but we're not there yet. And the Senate, Congress has to be involved in that. And for that reason alone, I don't think it's going to happen before the midterm elections. Could be wrong, but I don't think so. You don't have many days to November 8th, I believe, is Election Day. Matter of fact, that's less than 90. So stay tuned. I'll update you as we get better information. But I think that's generally good news for American consumers, as well as those that are already doing business in Mexico, or Mexican firms doing business with the United States. I'm a big fan of free trade, but you got to watch out for nations that will take advantage of other nations, and they're out there. And China's just one of several that have taken advantage of the United States. And let's be honest here, we've taken advantage of other nations. So what you're going to get ultimately is a managed trade agreement, hopefully with very low or no tariffs, and certain stipulations as to make sure that there are few, if any, non-tariff barriers to trade, and even fewer subsidies. So this is a win for President Trump, but I would not applaud until that agreement is signed on the dotted line and Congress has passed it. And I think they will, but it depends on the Democrats. Going to take Democrat votes to pass this. And this is favorable to the workers. And that's why I think the Democrats, at least some of them, should vote with Republican senators to pass this. But the devil is in the details, and there's a lot of details, and the American people can't keep up with this. That's why that we have a representative republic. It's up to our representatives to make sure that what the current Trump administration is doing is in the best interest of the United States, its people. And hopefully Democrats and Republicans can come together and agree and pass these bilateral agreements, and something that will replace NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement. But it's not a free trade agreement. It's a managed trade agreement. And it usually has things in it that has nothing to do with trade. But that's another show. Now, the second story, and I think this one will continue. Well, most of these stories will continue, except for the very last one. Iran, the Islamic Republic of Iran, claims that it controls the Strait of Hormuz. Now, you really need to look at a map. Every day, millions. I've heard 15, 16 million barrels of oil, a lot of oil, passes through the Strait of Hormuz. It's a shipping line. On one side, you have Iran that has a lot of oil and natural gas. On the other side, you have the UAE, the United Arab Emirates, Oman, Saudi Arabia. And guess what? The United States Navy patrols this area, escorts ships through it. And there are many, many. It's a very, very busy, busy waterway. You have the Persian Gulf. Some would say the Arab Gulf. It's the Persian Gulf, where you have Iraq on the northern part. You have Kuwait, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and then towards the south, United Arab Emirates. And then once you're through, the way to think of it, it looks like a boot where the Strait of Hormuz is the toe. And once you're through that roughly 29-mile, remember, big ships are passing through this. 29 miles sounds like a large area. Well, it is, but not when you have the number of ships passing through. And the fact on one side, you have the Iranians, and they somewhat harass, the Iranian Navy harasses our ships with these small speedboats. They have other more substantial vessels, but not many. It doesn't compare. We send aircraft carriers, destroyers, cruisers in it. Do I think Iran controls the Strait of Hormuz? Well, if it does, it won't control it for very long, because if we wanted to, the United States Navy could destroy the Iranian Navy in less than a day, a couple of hours. Now, you would think that when this type of message goes out, that this would maybe impact oil prices. Well, there's hardly been any impact at all. I don't think the United States at all takes this threat serious, and the people in the area don't take it serious. It used to be called saber rattling. I like the phrase rattle people's cages. In this case, it's, I think, meant more not for international consumption, but local domestic consumption, because you have the Iranian people are rebelling against the regime in Iran run by the mullahs. But who has all the guns? The government has all the guns. The Revolutionary Guard has all the guns. See, I think in some point in time, I don't know when, as the Iranian people will overthrow the existing regime that's been running the country, really since the overthrow of the Shah, and now it's time to overthrow the mullahs. It's a authoritarian or totalitarian regime. You don't particularly want to live there. They don't brook dissent. They're using religion to suppress the people in the country. And because the United States, under the leadership of President Trump, have reinstored sanctions and made it clear if European nations or any nations wants to do business with Iran, you will not be doing business within the United States. So you do have companies that are going to have to make a decision. And most, I won't say all, but most of them will say, I'm not going to invest in Iran or have operations in Iran if that means I can't operate in the United States. It's a cost-benefit analysis. Now, it does depend on what you're producing or selling, but the bigger market, the more prosperous market, the higher standard of living is in the United States. That's not even in doubt. So the United States, by reimposing sanctions on Iran, and they're going to get tougher soon, have made many European companies that rushed to do business with Iran once it was lifted under the Obama administration. And I agree with Trump. That was not the deal that should have been signed. Former President Barack H. Obama's legacy. Well, that's been scrapped. And now we're back to sanctions. The only thing I will say, sanctions take many years to work, and it does hurt the people of that country. The economy is not doing well, and the Iranian currency has declined in value, and they're going to have difficulties trying to sell that oil or gas. I don't think militarily, our military does not take this threat serious. Now, don't misunderstand me. They know. And this is important to understand, because this is rather close quarters when you're going through the strait. And even when you're out of it, while the Persian Gulf is big and the Gulf of Oman, which is on the other side, to the southeast of it is big. If by accident or intentionally either side opens on the other, we could be in a crisis situation. We could be at war. So you got to keep an eye on it. It is the major, I would say, choke point. That's what it's called. because, oh, I think the estimates I'm hearing is over 30% of petroleum that's shipped by vessels goes through that strait. And you can see why. You have Iraq, Kuwait, Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates, and ships, tankers, oil tankers. That's where they're filled, and then the way they get out of the Persian Gulf is they have to go through the Strait of Hormuz and then make a turn to the south to go through the Gulf of Oman and then on to their destination. It's a very busy channels for ships to go through. So we'll see what I see is happening right now. It's a war of words, and it's mainly for domestic consumption. However, my concern and the concern of many others is that either accidentally or intentionally we go to war with Iran. I think it would be a bad idea. Like I said, I'm not an interventionist at all. I am not. We need allies, and we have allies, and we've made alliances. But we should not intervene in any country until Congress declares war. And that's the problem. We're not following the United States Constitution. The last time we declared war was World War II. And there have been several hundred situations where we were at war, but none was declared. Now, sometimes they will authorize military force. There's no set wording of what a declaration of war is. The reason I'm rather insistent on this, and the founding fathers understood this and were wise, not giving the executive branch, namely the president, the authority to declare war. Because if you did, if we had it that way, we would have been in many wars. So as a check and balance on executive power, they gave Congress the power to declare war. But over the years, especially since World War II, we've more or less have an imperial presidency. And the United States today is considered the only superpower, although there are at least two that could come back. China wants to be a superpower, and they want the United States not to be the only hegemon. That's where you have a single nation dominating the world. And that's the situation today. We have over 400 or 500, last time I checked, bases. Many of them are small, but 30 to 40 are quite large, and many are in this Middle East here. We have become a warfare and welfare state, largely because both the Democratic Party and the Republican Party are big government parties. And because of that, we have a national debt, $22 billion and going up, and unfunded liabilities of 10 times that. Unfunded liabilities and obligations of over $200 trillion, where the United States economy this year will produce about $20 or $21 trillion. So the unfunded liabilities are at least 10 times that. There's no way we're ever going to pay that off. That's how bad the situation is. Now, I've given many shows on this, but I always bring it back to this, because what runs up all that debt? Government spending. On what? Number one is war. Number two is welfare programs. Number three is entitlement programs. You see, you could cut if you look at federal spending, excluding entitlement programs such as Social Security, Medicare, disability, Medicaid, and still Obamacare or the Affordable Care Act. Those are all entitlement programs. If you meet certain requirements, you paid money in, for example, you get the benefit. And the requirements that you have to meet are spelled out. We did not set aside money, nor did we truly invest the money to pay for those entitlements. Because the big one is Social Security, but also Medicare. Both are pay-as-you-go programs. The workers that are working today, you and me, if you're working, have a job, every paycheck they deduct money from your paycheck to pay for what? Your entitlements. But is that paying for your entitlements? No, that's paying for those people that are retired, either retired and are collecting Social Security or collecting Medicare. And because both parties are big government parties and they're engaged in Santa Claus socialism. And what I mean by that, vote for me and I'll give you some free stuff. I'll give you more benefit. Well, that's the racket. That's the game that's been played by both Democrats, especially Democrats. They're responsible for Social Security and Medicare. But both parties now pander, and that's the right word, to the voters by promising, vote for me, I'll give you more free stuff. As a result, to pay those benefits, especially now as Medicare has been in deficit, but Social Security soon will, there's not enough money there. So what do you do if you don't have money and you got to pay your bills? You borrow. That's what's going on. See, the biggest tax that most people pay, not everybody, are what's called payroll taxes for Social Security, Medicare, and disability. Because about 50%, actually a little bit more, but 50% of the people that pay taxes, income taxes, only less than 3% of those income taxes come from the bottom 50%. And many pay no personal income tax. But if you're in the bottom 50% and working, you're paying some income taxes. But the biggest tax you're paying is for entitlement programs, Social Security and Medicare, and disability. And there was no relief for that. And that's why I advocate replacing all federal taxes that are income tax-based, all federal taxes, with a one single tax, broad tax on consumption. And that would give tax relief to everybody, not just those that are earning large incomes and paying a considerable amount of money in income taxes. See, if you're not working or low income, your personal income taxes are small. But your biggest tax by far are for Social Security and Medicare. But it's not enough to pay for the benefits. It's not a phrase I use is it's not actuarially sound. You see, if you buy a private pension plan, for example, the money you contribute to that is invested in either stocks, bonds, whatever, however it's set up. And the reason they do that, because either the appreciation in the securities, whether stocks or bonds, as well as the income, will pay the benefits, should pay the benefits, and actuaries have to make sure they do. But that's not what the federal government did. It wasn't set up that way. It should have been set up that way. But we passed that point in 1935 and haven't changed it. Ultimately, what has to happen? One of really three things. We either cut benefits. That's not popular with voters, especially older voters, especially those that are retired and are not working. So we cut benefits, not a political winner. Or we increase taxes on it. That's not popular with those that are working and paying into Social Security and Medicare and disability. Young people, but it's really anyone that's still working, no matter what the age. And it would have to, if we truly just relied on taxes, it would have to more than double. Keep that in mind. I'm talking payroll taxes for entitlement programs that if you live long enough, in other words, if you live to 66, 67 for Social Security or 65 currently for Medicare, you get to that age and what do you say? Where's my money? Now, they're not going to give you all of it because they don't have it. What they're going to give you is a monthly check for Social Security. And most people can't live on that Social Security check. That's why you should have money set aside. And if you're fortunate, haven't lost it, you'll have enough to live on. We have sort of a house of cards. I know that was a famous television series, but a house of cards really describes the entitlement programs. And that's part of the problem. Remember, I started this discussion with part of the debt is due to war. Another part of the problem is these unfunded liabilities, because every day more and more baby boom generation, those born between 1946 and 1964, are retiring. Many are already retired. Those that were born in the late 50s, early 60s, most of them are still working, but they will be retiring soon. Eventually people die, and then no more Social Security checks, no more Medicare. Now, on a past show, I jokingly said, there's a lot of truth to this. The government really is trying to kill you. I'm trying to be provocative here. Why do I say that? What's the number one health problem today in the United States? By far. And it keeps getting worse, worse, and worse. It's obesity. The statistic that I quote, and it's going to get worse, 70% of the American population is either overweight or obese. They're fat. Now, the problem with obesity, and I know of what I speak, but I'm not alone, because 40% of the United States population is obese. Some are morbidly obese. And you know who I'm talking about. I'm not morbidly obese. I'm on the line, as is Donald Trump. He's obese, folks. He thinks he's overweight, but he's obese. And that's a problem with older people. As you grow older, you put on, every year, you just put on a couple of pounds. You do that for 30, 40 years. You're beyond overweight. You're just obese. And the problem with that, it leads to, it's a big risk factor of what? Heart disease, cancer, stroke, diabetes, hypertension or high blood pressure. It will kill you. It leads to things that will kill you. You're killing yourself. And it's a result of poor nutrition. Not that you're not getting enough food. You're eating too much of it or the wrong kind, and that leads to increase in weight. And as you get older, you tend to, you don't exercise as much. But what's scary is today you see this in young people at elementary schools, at high schools, and into college. I'm not saying we didn't have a few people like that when I was going through to elementary school or high school or college, but now it's not rare because 70% of the population, and it's really the entire population. Now, why did I say the government is trying to kill you? Well, guess what? If you're overweight or worse, obese, you're facing higher risk of the leading killers of people today. Oh, it might say a heart attack or a stroke or cancer, but you ate yourself to death. Obesity is the leading health problem of the United States, and we're virtually doing nothing about it. Why? Well, you're going to die a lot sooner than your expected life expectancy, whether it's in the 70s or 80s or beyond. So the government is making no effort whatsoever to educate you or encourage you to live longer. As I say, if you want to get back at the government, get healthy. I mean really healthy. Be your normal weight, not overweight, not obese. And I'm not going to get into the details of the numbers for the simple reason you can go online today and there are charts that will show you, depending on your male or female, what gender you are, what height you are, what body type you are. They'll tell you whether you're underweight, and that's the exception, normal weight, overweight, or obese. So if you want to check it out, go ahead. There are dozens of charts on it and they're in color and you can look it up and put in the information and weigh yourself. You also need to know your body mass index. I'm not going to get into that. But my point is the government wants you, they don't say this, by their actions are not addressing this. This should be the number one health issue. We should have a program first sensitizing people to the problem and working on it. Why don't we have that program? Oh, there's big money in maintaining the diet and the quantity of what we eat. And the only way, one way, think of it as a silver lining in one way, that the government can get out from under the Social Security benefits they have to pay as well as their Medicare. And you will be using it if you have these problems. Because I always, when I was in the financial service industry, I would say in terms of your medical bills, expenses, the highest ones, this is statistically not always the case, but your highest medical expenses are usually your last year of your life. Now, we don't know what that is. And actually, it's the 6 months leading up to it. Now, there are always exceptions to the rule, but that's when people have their heart attacks, their strokes, cancers, and other diseases. And the biggest risk factor is being obese. You're killing yourself by not eating right, eating too much, not getting proper exercise, proper sleep, and that saves the government a lot of money. So the government would like you to die early so they can get out from under all those benefits they promised you. So if you want to get revenge, live to 100 plus, you got to have the right habits, both in terms of eating habits as well as exercise and sleep. Don't forget that either. Now, I want to deal with a story that I frankly did not want to discuss. But it's in the news, and I know Catholics are disgusted about this. And what's interesting about this story is it deals with trust, or now lack of trust. Catholics, not all, but many Catholics would send their children to Catholic schools, either elementary, high school, and they have to pay for it. No taxes are going towards it. And what's the problem? You have priests that were predators, pedophiles. You also had priests that were homosexuals, and they would prey on the children, both male and female, as well as, because some of these people, some Catholics want to be priests, and they go to the seminary to get educated, and many do become priests. But unfortunately, you had these sexual predators, and it's all over the country. I know Pennsylvania is in the news, and that's a story of several weeks ago, and I didn't address it then. But the problem has been that the hierarchy of the Catholic Church, and it's a very flat hierarchy, You have priests, monsignors, bishops, archbishops, but they're really bishops too, and cardinals. They've been covering it up. They've been covering up this scandal, and it goes right into the papacy in Vatican City. Pope Francis has been accused of knowing about the problem with now no longer former Cardinal Theodore McCarrick. He was disciplined by the former Pope Benedict. And the cardinal that's accusing Pope Francis of knowing this says in 2013, I informed the Pope of what was going on. This is when this person was bishop in D.C. It was known, bordering on common knowledge amongst the priests, the Catholics in the area. And the former Pope, removed him from, for example, performing Mass. He was not to interact with the public. But when Pope Francis became Pope, he did away with that punishment, if you will, and restored him to his position of cardinal. Now, recently, he had to resign. To my knowledge, there's only been two cardinals that have had to resign. It was that bad, because he knew of it. Now, these are allegations. Nothing has been tried. You see, in my mind, if they weren't covering up, and the Catholic Church, its leadership, was covering up, these actions should have been reported to who? The police. They weren't. They hid it from their own congregation, moved people around, did not deal with it, quite frankly, to protect their parishioners. Now many Catholics are demanding that Pope Francis resign for his failure to take the appropriate action in this case. If anything, taking the exact opposite. He should have continued the sanctions or punishment that now retired Pope Benedict imposed on this cardinal. He didn't, because apparently this cardinal or former cardinal was partly responsible for the Pope being elected Pope. So Catholics are waiting to see what will be the response from Pope Francis. So far, it's silence. I suspect that the archbishop that informed the Pope is telling the truth. That's why he wrote this letter. And I think there will be an increasing demand that Pope Francis step aside as an example and require those cardinals that were also involved in the cover-up to retire, resign. That's what should be done. Will it be done? I don't know. And we'll have more information. This will be an ongoing story as it is today. You need to protect the children, teenagers, and parishioners from those priests that are either pedophiles or homosexuals. They should not prey on their own parishioners. And the expectation is the leadership of the Catholic Church, whatever the level, should deal with this honestly, forthrightly, and it should be adjudicated. You just don't say someone has committed this. Really, it should be handled by the police and a court of law, not by the church. That's my opinion. Finally, I'm not going to say much more. We learned this Saturday that Senator John McCain, earlier the week, we learned that he stopped treatment, and he did die of cancer Saturday. His funeral will be later this week. He will lie in state at the Senate Rotunda, and then I'm not going to get into those details. I admired his service to his country, both in the military and to serve in Congress. But he was very much a good example of what I call a big government Republican. Oh, yes, we had much agreement that we need a strong national defense. But he became, in his later years, very much an interventionist. I call him a warmonger, beating the drums. And why I think the United States needs to defend its country and its people. I adamantly disagreed with McCain in terms of intervening in country after country. That gets people killed, including the people that we in the country that were intervening. No one appointed us policemen of the world, and the sons and daughters of U.S. citizens, unfortunately, die. So my condolences go out to the family and friends of John McCain. His political philosophy is one that I simply don't agree with. It's costly, it's deadly, it's dangerous, and I could never support him. So may he rest in peace, and I do salute his service to his country and his courage. But that's not enough. You got to understand what's going on and what is truly the right thing to do. Even though you think what you're doing is the right thing to do, it may not be the right thing to do. So I think the American people will generally admire the service of John McCain. And may he rest in peace. Now, America the Beautiful. My name is Raymond Thomas Pronk, the presenter of the Pronk Pop Show. Views expressed on this show are my own, unless otherwise stated, and do not reflect the opinion of KDUX Web Radio, Richland College, or the Dallas County Community College District. You are listening to KDUX Web Radio, broadcasting live from Richland College in Dallas, Texas. We're the voice of Richland College. You are listening to the Pronk Pop Show, presented by Raymond Thomas Pronk, the People's Paladin Pronk, propagating faith, family, friends, freedom first. Broadcasted by Renaissance Radio, Radiating Reason, and KDUX Web Radio. Podcasted by PronkPops.wordpress.com. and KDUX Web Radio.wordpress.com.